Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing migration in Southern Africa. I'm joined by Dr. Rose Jaji, a senior researcher at the German Institute of Development and Sustainability. Dr. Jaji has written research and written extensively on migration, refugee issues, of gender, conflict, and peace-building issues. She is the author of the book, Deviant Destinations, Zimbabwe and Not to South Migration. Rose, it is a great pleasure to have you join me today. I've looked at your extensive publications. I definitely look forward to, you know, an exciting conversation with you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Brilliant. So let's begin with, we've seen, let's say in the last 10 years, maybe since the crisis in Europe in 2015, what they call the migration crisis, we've seen migration is like a big topic across in Europe and even in America. But also, whilst we look at that, we often forget that migration, like Devrali said, in Africa, there's more internal migration in Africa compared to outbound migration. So how would you describe the general migration pattern in, let me say, in Southern Africa?
Okay, thank you, Michael. What I would say is perhaps I could just start by saying migration in Southern Africa is historical. It goes all the way back to pre-colonial Africa. I mean, if you want to take it centuries back, you can even think about the Bantu migration, people moving from West Central Africa to the southern part of the country. And then you can even bring it forward to the 19th century, where you also see migration within the region. If you think about what is known as Mfecane in Nguniland in present-day South Africa, you see this is a period of political upheaval and people move northwards, cross into Zimbabwe, what is now Mozambique, Botswana, Zambia, Malawi, Tanzania, etc. So you see people have this tradition, so to speak, of moving around in Southern Africa. And then the colonial period, you see the same thing again, because remember many colonies in Southern Africa were settler colonies. So the white settlers were in need of labor in the mines and the commercial farms. So they relied on African labor on those farms and also in the mines. And then you see a lot of movement within the sub-region, where, for example, you see people moving from Malawi, Zambia into what was then Southern Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. Then you also see people moving from Southern Rhodesia to South Africa for better wages, from Malawi, Zambia, Mozambique, Lesotho, also to South Africa for better wages. And then post-colonial, post-independence Southern Africa, you still see a lot of migration happening. And then you also see it being intertwined with what is often referred to as forced migration. You know, it's not just migration in search of wage employment. It's also migration generated by conflicts in the region. So when you think about the pre-colonial period of Mfecane and the migrations that happened, Those people would fit into what we refer to as forced migrants or refugees in contemporary times. And then the colonial period, most of those countries, you look at Angola, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Namibia, South Africa, there were armed liberation struggles that also generated refugees, right? Mm-hmm. And then you also see these migrations also being characterized as forced migration. And currently, if you look at post-independent Southern Africa, you also see what is now referred to as mixed migration. You know, people migrating because of various reasons, be they economic, be they political. You know, you think about persecution of people by perhaps autocratic regimes in Southern Africa. So these are the main reasons and also the trends where you see people moving from countries that are struggling economically and countries that are facing political challenges to countries that are stable, you know, politically and economically stable. So generally, this is what you see in Southern Africa in a nutshell.
Brilliant. So so thank you for providing this, you know, this kind of like historical migration patterns from pre-colonial to colonial and then post-colonial patterns. So if you look at present day, you've mentioned some of these, which kind of like similar to pre-colonial times. You talk about, you know, the political pivots in the pre-colonial period, and also people also moved for economic issues as well. But these patterns, if you look at what countries usually the destination countries in South Africa, I think some countries have, in terms of like the scale of migrants that they attract and those that move, I think that would give us like a clearer understanding of, you know, the significance of each of the factors that are driving this. So which of the countries are the main destination countries and which are the ones that people are migrating from?
So obviously, you start by making a general statement where you say if people move from politically and economically troubled countries to those that are stable, then you ask yourself which countries are stable in the region. So you see South Africa being the powerhouse in Southern Africa and also perhaps on the continent. And then you see a lot of migration from many countries in Southern Africa in the direction of South Africa. And then also, you know, South Africa is quite vocal when it comes to migration from African countries. So a lot of attention obviously is given to this country. Of course, the numbers are huge and they also talk about it. So it's mainly South Africa, which is the main destination, being a big thriving economy. But then you also have these countries that tend to be a bit quiet, but they are hosting migrants from the region as well. If you think about Botswana, you think about Namibia, and then you think about the other countries that people generally do not talk about that much in Southern Africa. My experience is almost every country, if not all the countries in the region, host migrants, but then it's about the numbers. It's also about, you know, not really making it a big issue. So where migration is very politicized, you hear a lot about it to the extent that you would assume if you don't know anything about Southern Africa, you could easily assume people are only moving to South Africa or maybe to Botswana and Namibia. But then when you travel around, you find that the other countries quietly host migrants, quietly host refugees. So, for example, I was in Mozambique in July this year for research. And then, you know, I met people from Somalia who actually run shops in Mozambique. Everything is quiet. So I'm like, oh, wow, you also have migrants in this country, first migrants. And then they said, yes, we live with them. We're used to them being here with us. So it's no big deal. So, yes, you have South Africa having a lot of migrants. But then that's not to say that other countries do not have them as well. I come from Zimbabwe and people don't even think about Zimbabwe hosting migrants. But then I wrote a book about migrants from the global north who live in Zimbabwe. Those are migrants. Majest people wouldn't want to characterize them as such. And then we also have refugees in Zimbabwe. The camp, Tongogara refugee camp in Zimbabwe, hosts around 11,000 refugees from the Horn of Africa, but also mainly from Central Africa. But then we rarely hear this being spoken about.
I was going to come to that in a minute. How the double standard in the lexicon that sometimes the global north use to describe this movement from north to south, and how they that kind of like power dimensions. But I want to stay on this one for a minute. Like, we had a good friend of my colleague is in University of Zimbabwe, come talk about land issues, land displacements in Zimbabwe, and how, you know, people have been displaced and movement to Mozambique. I'm glad you mentioned Mozambique, you know, and then people are going to Mozambique and all of that. So I guess the question would be, we've seen also where there's in East Africa, for instance, you could talk about Somalia, where Somalia is was a failed state, and you know, with Al-Shabaab and all the conflict. You could talk about other East African countries, maybe in DRC, talk about the other armed groups in DRC, many armed groups in DRC. You could go to the Sahel, talk about armed groups, and you could say, okay, this you could talk about Sudan. But in South Africa, I don't think there's a country in South Africa where we have a major conflict, whether maybe Mozambique, besides Mozambique, where we have the kind of like Islamic stuff in the north, or Kabul there in Mozambique. But besides that, I've not seen where we have a major conflict group in Mozambique, in South Africa. So I was wondering why. So if you look at the scale of migration in South Africa compared to other parts, East Africa, West Africa, and all of that, is it, how would you define, look at this, describe the scale? And would you not say it's economic migration that is really driving? Is the economy that is driving this compared to other parts of Africa?
Okay, what I could say is that now you look at the country of origin, and then that can also help you understand the reasons for migration better. So if you look at countries that are not experiencing conflict, usually it's migration because of economic reasons, where people are just looking for opportunities, economic opportunities. And then you have countries such as Zimbabwe, my country. This is a combination of factors or a combination of reasons for migration. So you have the economic reasons. Obviously, I think many people are aware of the economic challenges, the protracted economic situation in the country, crisis in the country. So that has generated people for economic reasons. But at the same time, we can't deny that there are also people who fled the country because of political reasons. When you talk about human rights violations, when you talk about the challenges that people who are politically active face, you know, the detentions and things like that. So there are some people who have also fled the country because of fear for their lives, that their lives are in danger in Zimbabwe because of their political activities. So you see this combination when you look at Zimbabwe. Some are fleeing because of economic reasons, others are fleeing because of political reasons, or a combination of these two reasons. You know, you have political and economic reasons combining to force people, to eject people out of Zimbabwe. And then you look at countries such as Zambia, it's a quiet country, you know. Sometimes these countries are so quiet, people rarely talk about them, but then it quietly receives refugees from DRC Congo, from DR Congo. And then it also has people who move as migrants. You know, when you think about student migration to South Africa, you also see some Zambian students moving to South Africa, just like the other countries in Southern Africa. And then you have countries where people may move but you don't get to hear about it that much. For example, when you are here in Europe, you can meet people from any country in Southern Africa. You can meet people from Malawi, people from Botswana, people from Namibia. And then, you know, people would generally want to ask, your country is doing well, why are you here? But then well is very subjective. You know, people are always looking for things they may not find in their countries, despite the fact that these countries may not be facing the kinds of economic and political challenges that you may find in, for example, Zimbabwe, or for example, in Mozambique, if you talk about Cabo Delgado. And then that violence could also generate forced migration. So really, there are countries that are very conspicuous when it comes to migration in terms of sending out people as migrants and receiving them. And then you also have these countries that I'd like to refer to as quiet participants. You know, they receive migrants and send them, but you don't hear a lot about it. And sometimes we also forget the two small countries, Eswatini and Lesotho. You know, people just talk about South Africa. And then they forget we also have those two countries in Southern Africa. And they tend to be very invisible because of their size. But they are also members of the Southern African region.
Let's say you've written, you know, maybe more on Zimbabwe. Let's stay on Zimbabwe for a minute. So I would say in South Africa, After Nigeria, Zimbabweans are the ones that face a lot of xenophobic attack in South Africa, in my opinion. And also looking at the recent pronouncements by the Botswana president about Zimbabwe, and I've read somewhere that they were saying that perhaps 95% of migrants in Botswana are from Zimbabwe. What is your take on that, on why Zimbabweans are targeted? Are Zimbabweans the highest migrants in among the South African community?
I think one would need to consider the protracted nature of the economic and political problems in Zimbabwe. So, for example, the last 2 decades, the country hasn't really enjoyed much economic and political stability. So what that translates into is migration, obviously. And then what many people complain about migration do not realize is that many people generally migrate to neighboring countries. So naturally, you find a lot of Zimbabweans who have migrated being in neighboring countries that we share borders with, mainly South Africa, for reasons that I gave at the beginning, and also Botswana and then Namibia. Then you also have Zimbabweans in Zambia, Malawi, Mozambique, but in smaller numbers than South Africa, for example. So I think, you know, where migrants tend to be very conspicuous, people tend to be hostile because it's all about visibility. You know, the more visible migrants are, the more hostility they generate because people start thinking about these people coming to take over, coming to displace us, in terms of economic displacement, even sociocultural displacement. So the hostility is mainly about feeling inundated. You know, there are too many of them here. And if we don't curb these kinds of movements, we're going to lose our country. I mean, you hear this everywhere, not only in Southern Africa. You look at Europe and you hear this kind of narrative about we're going to lose our country. So I guess it's the same thing that you find a lot of Zimbabweans in South Africa, because we're a neighboring country and our challenges have been quite protracted. So people are thinking, well, since the issues have not been resolved, they're going to keep coming to us. And, you know, our country cannot keep accommodating these people. They must fix their country. And then it goes on. I'm sure you're familiar with the language.
Yeah.
You know, fix your country. You don't run away from your country. You fix your country. And we're not responsible for your problems. So please don't come and burden us with those problems. So so it is. I think that's mainly the reason. Of course, when people feel that there are too many migrants, usually they don't have positive views. So you also see migrants being linked to crime. You know, if I tell you that Zimbabwe is a very low crime rate, that we rarely hear about violent crimes, shootings and stabbings in public places and things like that, you know, you wouldn't believe me. because you mainly hear about Zimbabwean migrants being referred to as criminals, so you're thinking it must be so bad where they're coming from. But then it's part of the narrative, you know, you have to demonize people in order to justify your negative attitude towards them. So one of the forms of demonization would be labeling people criminals. You know, they bring crime, they stab people, they bring diseases, even they bring drugs, you know, all kinds of things. So I guess that's how it works when there are a lot of people coming from any country. You know, they become the problem.
I agree. I've been looking at recently. I've been looking at the myth of migration, and one layer is to look at Europe and look at how there's the greater percentage of people that migrate from Africa is within Africa. And that's one myth. And the other myth is again we look at. I think we also had one professor from Oxford that was looking at xenophobia in South Africa. And each country needs to have maybe about 6% of the population, and it wasn't even up to that. So, like, that validates what you're saying about how these narratives are amplified in a very malicious way. To because migrants are like, you know, not even up to the national percentage that they give for migrants. But let me go to the colonial stuff. So you look at the legacy. So if you look at them. Pre-colonial times, there's always the notion that, you know, African states were arbitrarily created. So there's always the notion that Africans had kind of like sort of free movements. And we didn't have other states, Zimbabwe, or, you know, we could have other kind of like society, the way society were organized during that times. So now if we look at the colonial heritage and look at what colonialism, and then look at it back again, bring it back to your book and look at how the white farmers, I know during Mugabe, you know, there was that policy, that nationalization where white farmers were, where the farms were kind of like renationalized. And in the last episode we had, I guess, also talked about how indirectly the white, although they're black faces, black capitalists, but they're working in disguise for the white people, they're reclaiming those. I don't know if you can speak on that. And so, but I wanted to talk about one, the double standard in terms of how, like from what you say in the book, the north-south migration pattern, which is quite relevant, number one. And two, another thing I've seen as well is recently the United Kingdom did call for teachers from countries in the Caribbean and Nigeria and Zimbabwe. So look at, even though these migrants are being demonized and say, oh, there's so many migrants, yet the, you know, labels are needed from these countries. So how do you speak generally to this? Is this double standard or the continued north-south kind of like dichotomy when it comes to migration issue?
I mean, it's quite historical, because if you listen to that double standard, you would think that it's only people from the so-called global south who are moving. I know some people are uncomfortable with that term, but then for the sake of progress, I'll refer to as the global south. When people move from the global south, the tendency is to assume that this movement is unidirectional. No one is moving from the global north. But then historically, we have seen these movements from the global north to the global south, but they're not demonized. Because of the rhetoric within which they are couched. So if you look at settler colonialism, for example, what was said about settler colonialism? We're going to civilize the barbarians. You know, Africans are primitive, so we are going to civilize them, to introduce them to medicine and science and things like that. So that history persists, where we continue to see, even the terminology, when people are moving from the global north, they are not exactly referred to as migrants, you know. So that book actually said migration and migrants, you know, it was deliberate. Mm-hmm. Usually people are thinking they're expatriates. They are bringing, I don't know, employment and money to Africa, for example. And then when Africans move out of Africa, they are bringing problems. They don't have anything to offer even if you have highly educated Africans migrating, you know, they're just lumped together as Africans. Then these stereotypes that are usually applied to Africa, often used, you know, Africans have problem, African migrants, and so on. So because of that, we come to this point where high income countries or countries in the global north tend to, they do realize they need migrants. But then they can't just say, okay, migrants can come and work here, because they're also pandering to the electorate in their countries. You know, how are people going to vote? So if people do not want migrants here, I mean, you're aware of what happened recently in the United States elections, you know, and then migration. So if the voters do not want migrants to come, but at the same time, the economy needs migrants, what do you do? So you become selective, you pacify the voters by telling them, we're not telling anybody to come here. They have to come legally, and we'll choose who comes here, so people are kind of, you know, secure. They are not so scared. So when you hear the United Kingdom being that selective, basically what they're saying is that they're people who are useful and people who are not useful. So, I mean, look at this contradiction. It's the same country that was trying to send people to Rwanda recently, right? Yeah. And at the same time, they're also trying to invite people to come and work in the United Kingdom, like you rightly pointed out. And then you're asking yourself, what's going on there? There are people who are wanted. I think this is Stephen Castles, who has written about people who are welcome and desirable. So if you happen to be the person who is categorized as undesirable, then you're not wanted. You know, they don't come here. There's no space for you. There's nothing for you here. Stay where you are or go elsewhere if you still want to move, but not here because this economy is too advanced for people like you, you know, that kind of thing. But if you're well-educated, yeah, we think you fit into the labor market here because we need your skills. So yes, the door is open. I mean, look at this situation where the borders get closed for some people and open for others, so that in the end, you cannot exactly say, no, they don't like migrants, or they are racist and all these kinds of things, because you're seeing the door being opened for some people who look different and then being closed for other people who look like those who are able to move. So in the end, you look at global migration, you see these kinds of contradictions. It boils down to who is useful in the global market, labor market. If you are deemed to be useless, so to speak, then it's difficult for you to move.
The irony is very mind-blowing, because I recently just come back from a conference in Warsaw, and one of the participants was talking about the competition between China and the West when it comes to like the green economy, and so we're kind of like pointing to Congo, DRC. You look at how China kind of like have hegemony when it comes to like access to the materials needed for this. And then the guy was talking about the United States. The West needs to be aggressive, use everything in its power to you know, reduce the gap and stake it, protect its future, whatever, when it comes to that. Now, but we look at how that also displaces people. This place is the whole lot of displacement in this place where these lands are being mined. And, you know, I'm seeing similar stuff in Zimbabwe, where the guy was talking about the sugarcane plantation, the guest that I spoke with, and how these places, people have been displaced from their land, you know, in these places. But then I guess the question I wanted to say is, in Africa, we've seen less economic integration, less, which will be defined by movement of goods and movement of persons. So I know recently there was the continental free trade, but also this continental free trade also relies on regional, already existing regional stuff like ECOWAS, like SODOC. So what is SODOC? So someone has the free movement policy, the free movement of persons. How effective is that?
It's a bit difficult. I think that's one of the paradoxes of, you know, if you want to talk about globalization and, you know, this celebration of people being able to move, etc. And then you look at the sub-regional level, And then you're like, this idea of accelerated cross-border or trans-border mobility, how is it working out? Goods can move freely between countries, but then the problem is mainly when it comes to human movement or human mobility. You know, you find these tendencies to try and erect barriers so that people cannot move. So you do have things in the SADC protocol on free movement of persons, talking about, you know, visa-free movement for 90 days. You can enter and stay for 90 days without a visa. Then you have the right to establishment and things like that. But in practice, things do not always work the way they appear on paper. There's resistance. So, you know, the irony is that we didn't create the borders that we recognize currently. But then we're so protective of these borders to the point that we even forget who we were before the borders were created. So that's why I gave that historical angle to the conversation where I was talking about pre-colonial migration. So, you know, when we talk about our countries, I think you may also notice this in West Africa, that you have pre-colonial nations straddling borders at the moment. And then these people struggle to cross the borders legally. They have to do it without maybe the permission of the state, because the state is insisting you need a passport. And then to these people, it's not making sense. A passport for what? This is our land, you know? This is our ancestral land. So, of course, it's not your country, but it's our land because, you know, we're looking at the history of this land. But then when it comes to mobility in Southern Africa, we face these kinds of challenges that, you know, border regions are populated by ethnic groups that you find on both sides of the border. Mm-hmm. But then the mobility is restricted. Imagine telling someone to travel 300 kilometers in order to cross the border when they can easily cross it to maybe somebody who lives 7 kilometers from their homestead. Mm-hmm. But then you're telling them, if you cross there, that's illegal. The legal way is for you to go to this city. That's where we have the official crossing point. And then you cross the border and you go and see your cousins on the other side or whoever you want to see there, or your chief. I mean, these kinds of things are really hampering mobility in Southern Africa. And also the politicization of migration. You know, like I said at the beginning, when people look at those who are crossing the border, not as fellow Africans, but as a problem, then you see a lot of resistance in terms of who can come in. And then when they come in, do we want them to even naturalize? I mean, it's quite interesting. I mentioned people who left because of Fetane. And now when these people go back to South Africa, they are not considered as quote-unquote relatives. They're foreigners, you know, but historically they trace their ancestry to South Africa, present-day South Africa. But then you don't hear these kinds of conversations. You know, we don't really want to talk about it because we're thinking about borders. Those on the other side are strangers. They are foreigners. We don't want them here. So I would say until people understand this history and situate contemporary migration in this history, it's going to be difficult for people to cross borders, not only in Southern Africa, but also on the continent at large.
One of the, so there's a special issue I'm editing, and I'm also kind of like working on a book on democracy and kind of like militarization in Africa, contemporary. I'm looking at, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's, I've always said that how we staunchly defend the arbitrary creation of states in Africa, and how the elites, like even the African Union, you know, how people defend these borders that were externally created. And then you look at, for instance, look at the Lake Chad, the stuff you've mentioned, look at Boko Haram, look at these places where some of the places in the border city of the Northeast Nigeria have their kits and kin in Chad, for instance, in Niger. And you know, these people don't see all of those borders and how that creates, but also in East Africa as well. I think in East Africa, you have that kind of situation going on. And that still continues that kind of like alien citizen kind of narrative that the colonialists manipulated. But I don't know. I'm looking at it in terms of like the adopted system that Africa adopted, the colonial systems of democracy, or colonial systems of the idea of the state, or the idea of what a state is, or how you define citizens. But how do we look at it within the migration issues? How do we address this? Do you see hope? Because I don't know how. Because again, you look at the continent. The continent is one that has great, huge potential when it comes to like the youth, and then these youths are becoming, anyways, far removed from the history. I'm glad you say we need to look at the history, the far removed from the history, but they're also becoming more liberal, more open. But I don't know, because you look at what's going on in Mozambique in the recent election, where those that fought for liberation are beginning to lose somehow their grip on stuff. You look at it in South Africa as well, with the ANC, with the last election. You see all of this happening. How do you see that? Do you see this as kind of like indication of the future, that these narratives are going to be challenged? These old guards are going to need to fall. And I don't know if you see any prospects, or if you see this as signal to that happening.
Yeah, I think, everything serves a purpose for a particular period, and thereafter it becomes perhaps useless. So if you look at Southern Africa, like I said, most of the settler colonies were in that part of Africa. So it was easy for these political parties to use their legitimacy deriving from their role in liberating the countries in Southern Africa and say, we are the right people, we liberated you. But then if you look at the population right now, not only in Southern Africa, but Africa at large, this is the majority is young. Many of the people in Southern Africa, if you hear about the percentages, people below the age of 15 or people between the ages 15 to 29, this is the majority. And then when you ask yourself, which country was liberated last in Southern Africa, right? And you look at countries such as South Africa and you're like, since 1994, how many years have passed? So you have people who are now young adults who were born in 1994. And then you can't keep selling this kind of narrative to these people. And also the situation has changed. People are more aware of what is happening around the world. Like all of us, I think most of us were watching the elections in the United States. And then you see what happens there. You see how people talk about issues. You see how the economy is a major issue. And then you're like, how come we don't talk about it here? How come it's not an issue here, right? Mm. And then you start focusing on these issues because you're also learning the world is not very open. You can't keep listening to people keep telling you we did this, so we're entitled to continue ruling. Because you're thinking, this is not leadership. You are just ruling. And we don't want to be ruled. We want to be led. And I think because of this, one, the failure to deliver and to keep, talking about this liberation narrative or liberation credentials. And these young people do not have patience. You can't keep telling them this, that, we liberated this country, because now they retort and say, perhaps that system was better than this. We don't see the difference. So they challenge this kind of narrative. We liberated you, so you must be grateful, etc. So I think we're going to see more of this. I mean, if you look at what happened in Botswana recently, the defeat of the ruling party, which had ruled for the last 58 years. And then that defeat was, it was convincing. You couldn't even dispute it and say maybe there was a mistake somewhere, can we have a recount and things like that. It was just clear, we don't want you anymore, as simple as that. So I think we are going to see more of these kinds of trends where people are thinking, let's try something new. You can't keep doing the same thing for more than 40 years and expect different results. So if we can't get the results that we want from the incumbent, let's try somebody new. But then the question is whether leaders in these different countries are prepared to accept this change and say, yeah, we understand what is happening. I think what we're likely to see is acceptance in some countries and a lot of resistance in other countries. And I'm not sure what's going to happen to this kind of resistance to change, whether it can be sustained or eventually it's going to collapse. And then, you know, these countries have new systems as well, just like those where it's easy to change governments.
I do agree. I do agree, because sometimes we are kind of like disposed to talk about Africa as one and, without looking at the nuance, look at with the nuance lines and look at, you know, some of the, I could cite maybe Senegal, for instance, and look at what happened during Senegal. Look at, also look at even Mozambique, no matter how much you look at, we look at, you know, even the president that won, even though he's from the old guard, he's just a young, he was born after independence. And then we look at, I think the president of Mozambique as well, is about in, Botswana is in his 40s as well. And so I agree with you that, there might seem to be some sort of shifts, even though these are kind of like little shifts. But one striking thing, you know, looking at preparing for this and looking at it, is like South Africa stands out from the other part of, like for East Africa, for instance, in the side, I was going to say, in North Africa, for instance, in terms of like conflicts or perpetual wars and all of that. Since South Africa is a bit different, it's more economics. So I was going to say, if we come to like, let's conclude this with a group, you know, let me give you the wide net to conclude and look at what do you think can be done in South Africa to create a more inclusive, effective migration policies? What can be done? Looking at that, it's the least, in my opinion, it's the least troubled zone in terms of like conflict, in terms of like maybe Islamic jihadist issues or other stuff. So shouldn't it be like a model? For me, it should be like a model region and to propel the continent towards how it should be done. I don't know. But what do you think can be done if you're going to conclude?
I think firstly, these countries, I mean, when you have a body like SADC, I think it needs to be strengthened so that, you know, when it speaks, it makes a lot of sense, and there needs to be unity in Southern Africa. As it is, I don't think there's a lot of unity at the moment. That's my opinion, but people may disagree. Because you have countries that are at different levels, especially in relation to democracy. You know, you have countries where it's easy to change leadership. If the voters want to change the leaders, it's so easy. They simply vote them out and bring in new leaders and everyone accepts it. So they have strong institutions. And then, like I said, you have countries where there's a lot of resistance. So when you have that kind of tensions, like right now they are discussing Mozambique and it seems they're not speaking with one voice. Or they are not seeing the same things when they look at what's happening in Mozambique. People are seeing different things there. I mean, how does that happen? So you can't strengthen a region when there are divisions like that. Of course, they may not be overt, but then still, everybody knows there are divisions, especially when you look at Mozambique. Even Zimbabwe, you know, if we look at the last 20-something years, there have always been divisions, but then, you know, they talk about African diplomacy, so you don't really get to hear a lot about these divisions. But if you are an observer who is keen, you can see the divisions. So I would say for Southern Africa to play an important role on the continent, yes, you're right, we rarely have like civil wars. Since the end of the civil war in Mozambique, it's unfortunate that in 2017 it resumed, but in one province. But for the greater part of the history, when you look at most of the countries in the region, after independence, they didn't really have civil wars. So they could have really, you know, used that to try and say, let's see what role we can play on the continent of Africa. What can we contribute, especially in terms of, you know, peace building, and also in terms of, you know, economic development, in terms of trade. But I think, as long as the countries are divided, and as long as you have the countries being at different levels of economic development, it's going to be difficult, because there's need for internal coherency and internal understanding within the sub-region of Southern Africa before that sub-region can engage the rest of the continent. For example, if you want to talk about migration, how can Southern Africa talk about migration or free movement for Africans when it's so difficult for people to just cross one border? So how is it going to be like if people are moving from another sub-region altogether? You know, so these kinds of situations where you have attempts to move towards regional integration and also attempts to protect these borders, these are contradictions. How then do you manage to speak with one voice if you have these kinds of, you know, national interests and this kind of this lack of harmony between the member states of SADC, for example? So there is a lot of potential in other ways. There's a lot of potential. But then, you know, as with the rest of the continent, the potential is there, but it seems we don't know what to do with it. We don't know how to unleash it. So we just see it. Yeah, we have the potential. But then it seems we are lethargic or we are paralyzed. So in the end, we keep talking about our potential, but we don't really get to do anything about it. And I see that in Southern Africa as well.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yes, but we do have loads of potential, even right now where it looks like there's a rebirth of another scramble for Africa, where Africa is having lots of leverage at the international, and we just need, I don't know what we need. We need some visionary leadership to just take charge of that. But we can always just be optimistic and hope that, you know, we would have that kind of be able to harness the potentials that we do really possess. But well, thank you very much for your very, very rich insight into this what I believe is an important topic to have. We're very grateful to have you join us. I'll keep you posted, and you know, we'd definitely want you to help share the word so that, you know, to get to the right people that need to do what they need to do. Thank you very much, Rose.
Thank you so much, Michael. It was a pleasure having this conversation. Thank you.
Same here. Yeah, you have a great day.
Same to you. Bye.
Bye. Thank you once again for joining me in another interesting episode with Dr. Rose Jaji discussing migration in Southern Africa. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I will therefore implore you to subscribe to the channel, like this video, and join me again next week for more interesting and exciting episodes. For now, stay blessed and I'll see you soon.